Americas joined the list of uncertainties, and all the other risks seem quaint and trivial by comparison.
So for today, it's definitely all about North Korea.
The Dow up 20%, pretty much 19% since the election. NASDAQ up 20%. So the S&P right up there at 14%. But will the president be willing to watch this victory go up in a cloud of smoke?
I'm astonished that at a time of maximum international crisis, they describe our president as a nut with a nuke.
Well, you know, my critics are only saying that because it's me. If somebody else uttered the exact same words that I uttered, they'd say, what a great statement, what a wonderful statement.
You know, the rhetoric is bellicose and it's throaty.
And for the president not to warn the adversary, don't do it, in the harshest possible terms, would be irresponsible at best.
Or if he does anything with respect to Guam or any place else that's an American territory or an American ally, he will truly regret it, and he will regret it fast.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it is a sea of red ink across the board of the major indexes this week. We also hit a new record in the Dow earlier in the week that was spoiled as tensions build between the U.S. and North Korea. Is this the beginning of another crisis similar to the Cuban Missile Crisis? Well, that's what the media would have you believe. We're going to dispel that myth on the program. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in Hour 1 will be Art Hill from StockCharts.com. He still thinks we are in a long-term trend for the stock market. It remains intact. There is one area that's beginning to deteriorate. He'll talk about that. Bonds, stocks, gold, you name it, they're all positive correlated, and they are all in a uptrend. So Art will be my technician this week. Later on in the program, you're going to want to listen to this against the hysteria that is literally going on with the media now over North Korea. Todd Mariano from Renaissance Macro will be joining us, and he's talking about, you know what, this thing about North Korea is much overblown. As we look at the geopolitical spots from North Korea to Venezuela to Turkey and the Middle East, all of that is coming up in Hour 1 along with Ryan Poplava on what moved the markets this week.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, if you've been a listener to our show for a long time, you know that we cover several topics. First of all, we cover the leading economic indicators and their relationship to the economy. Also, the Federal Reserve, because its policies determine what happens in the financial markets and how you should invest. And one of the other things we try to do is try to alert you to changes. Now, aligned with this will be our topic today for the big picture, risk management. How you do it, why you should do it, and how to master your own worst investment nightmare, which is you and your emotions, being either fear or greed, and they can get you into a lot of trouble if you don't think coolly. You know, what we have coming out of the media nowadays, aside from supporting various narratives rather than actually reporting the news, there's a lot of data points. And data points sometimes are hard to organize into something that makes any sense. So in the second part of the big picture, we'll discuss the art of contrary thinking and the danger of the mass media and how to overcome it. Because sometimes when they're yelling, the sky is falling, maybe it really isn't falling. And that's because of the need of media to get ratings. And so they have become more and more sensational. But you don't wish to be that if you're going to keep careful track of your investments. All of that coming up today on The Big Picture in the Financial Sense News Hour. But before we do all of that, Ryan Poplava back here on the show this week. The thought on everybody's mind isn't so much why the market dropped, as many agree it's related to saber rattling between North Korea and the United States, or more specifically between Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump. But this seems, the question we have to ask, is this enough fear to drive the equity markets into a deeper sell-off? So let's just hit this concern right out of the gate here as we start the show.
Yeah, great question, John. And it's definitely the question probably on every investor's mind right now. I can tell you from strictly just a technical standpoint, from research we did 2 weeks ago we took a look at seasonally what happens the S&P 500 in August. Also, given we've already had a great run up recently in the last few months. And as we've experienced, the S&P 500 has shown us since 2007, looking at corrections in August from basically the peak to trough, not saying the month itself on a calendar, but just if there was a correction from peak to trough, maybe it was August 7th to the 20th or August 10th to the 14th. If there was a correction, what was it typically? And sometimes when we looked at it, the worst was 2011. There was a 13.4% correction. And the smallest was last year's, was about 0.8%. But if we just look at it, every single year there was a dip in August. And the median was around 3.9%. That's right in the middle. And the mean, the average, was around 5% decline. So historically, let's look at that as a frame of reference right now. We've seen a decent amount of volatility in August's pasts, but the S&P 500 large cap index is not oversold. So if we talk about it technically, the very small dip we got this week, oh my God, yes, down 1% or in change Thursday. Are we oversold now? Are we ready for the market to move back up? No, the conditions are not right from a technical standpoint to say that, hey, the market is oversold. We have, you know, a chance from buyers to step in. Hasn't happened yet. So given what I'm looking at on a lot of my indicators, momentum, participation is another word for breadth. We're looking at how many stocks are trading above their 200-day moving average in the S&P 500. And that number currently on Friday, the last I checked, was around 64%. It's pretty good. When you get above 70, we call that overbought. You've got very strong participation in the market's advance, many stocks above the 200-day average. In the past, we've seen corrections. You take a look at the Chinese yuan devaluation back in August of 2015. The percentage where breadth got to at that point was only 14% of stocks were above their 200-day average. So we very much got oversold in that time, and it gave way to a nice rally afterwards. So the election correction that we saw leading up to whether it was going to be Hillary or Donald, that correction we got down to as low as really only 50%. So are we there yet? No, not really. We are near some short-term support areas, and there's this chance that we could see some aggressive kind of buy the dip trading. We saw that on Friday based on, you know, CPI figures being tame, likely anticipating that the Fed also is not going to be as aggressive towards raising interest rates. So that's why the market was up on Friday, and also maybe a little bit of a bounce back. But I think the main thing I'm looking at right now on the S&P 500 is looking at the 50-day moving average. We passed through that on Thursday, and it acted as a buffer intraday on Friday. That was 2448. And that's the number I'm watching right now. So, you know, if our listeners are looking for, you know, is this fear going to create a deeper sell-off? Maybe we should talk about that more. But for right now, we're not in the conditions yet to say that, you know, bottom's in place.
Well, Ryan, would you agree that this correction is really fear-based around the chest pounding we see going on between North Korea and the U.S.? Or in reality, are there deeper issues that maybe the public are being complacent towards recently?
It's a good question, John. And I think, you know, the fear behind North Korea and the possibilities right now between a conflict has definitely been the match that has been lit, but there's been some kindling that's been growing. I mean, leading up to this week's jawboning, the Dow Jones transports, they were underperforming. I talked about that 2 weeks ago. The Russell 2000 small cap index was underperforming. We continue to have partisan politics in Washington, and despite, we talked about this 2 weeks ago, we looked at the earnings season. How was it progressing? Very strong. There was essentially no real explosion in response to buying in these companies that should have really reflected the strong earnings season we've been having. You know, that didn't surface. So that also was a kind of that kindling to this dip and possible correction here this month that's been being placed here in the fireplace. And therefore, you know, the market was, as I said, it's really, it was susceptible to really any bad news to kind of take profits. You know, it's looking like, let's talk about Jeff Gundlach, 2 weeks ago, major purchase in puts. We saw the VIX spike as a result of his purchase and discussion of that. And it's looking like, you know, the volatility index we look at this week, it's up like 60% since Jeff made those purchases. So our feeling right now, John, is that this will be a dip and a buying opportunity given most of the fundamentals are still sound. Very strong earnings season. Earnings have been growing. And as I mentioned, it's not just earnings. Revenue was at a phenomenal place, phenomenal growth this season. There's accommodative monetary policy. There's been a lot of expectations. They're not going to go again till maybe December. We saw that, like I said, the CPI was out this week, was up 0.1% in July. And the PCE number that the Fed watches very closely, year over year, only up 1.4%. So well below their target. So we're going to have an accommodative Fed. Earnings and revenue growth is here. Okay, let's look at the other side of just a T-chart here. You know, look at the defensive area of the market. Let's look at gold. Let's look at treasuries. Gold is up, but it's still under 1,300. 1,300 is that key level I've been talking about all year long that has been rebuffed, I think, around three different times. Volatility is up, yes, but it isn't any higher than we've seen from other mild dips over the past year and a half. I checked in with three technicians, John, this week. John Krinsky at RenMac was modeling about a 3.4% decline. That's his primary target right now from the top. John Betts at Vermilion mentioned the same area to me as well, right around 2,400. But basically both looking at these July lows, the previous lows last month, Krinsky's second target. So let's say things do get worse. What is he modeling? And he thinks this maybe later on this year, maybe September, October. He thinks 5.5% down from the top we saw this week. And then I think we're going to have Art Hill on the show, aren't we, from StarkCharts.com. I read from him this week that he says that the primary trend is intact. We are well above the 200-day average on the S&P, and that could take us down to those other levels that Krinsky was talking about. So for the most part, most of the technicians I'm talking to, my own work, we're looking at a short-term dip here.
So besides Korea and the United States and their interchange between Kim Jong-un and President Trump, it does really appear that the news this week is, in fact, the market itself. And you and I talked about the possible complacency of a correction, given how low volatility indicators were when you mentioned Jeff Gundlach of Double Line Capital bought those puts 2 weeks ago. And I read an article recently that he's betting the S&P will fall at least 3% by the end of the year, potentially sending those puts up 400%. As a matter of fact, he told CNBC, with the Dow sitting at 22,151, that was 3 days ago, there were way too many people shorting the VIX.
My point is that when we get whatever correction is coming, and obviously after 10 up days, it would be completely normal to have a couple of down days that maybe equate to 3%. If that happens, I think the VIX will easily go to 20.
Yeah, so right, John, VIX going to 20, it's volatility. He was betting on volatility. He did say the market's going to drop, but he said, yeah, I think volatility is going to go up. We looked at 2 weeks ago, the VIX below 10 at a 52-week low when he made those purchases. It was a great move. A very wise investor, and definitely from what I've known, one of the best timers I've seen in the fixed income market. Really, if you look at his work, knowing when to lengthen and shorten duration and when to hedge, clearly is as shown out this week. It just shows with the action this week how kind of pertinent it has been to really discuss not just, oh yeah, the market going up every day. Yay, yay, yay. Cheer, cheer, cheer. Here's some pom-poms. No, it's, hey, risk management is still always a part of the equation. There's always a level of risk when you're jumping into equities, even precious metals. You know, everyone calls gold safe. Gold is not safe. It's an investment. Some people, it's a philosophy. Yes, I understand that, but it's still a commodity. It's an investment. It can go down. And we saw that from 1900 down to almost 1,000. I didn't get a chance to discuss it last week on the show. I was actually sick. I'm sorry. But 2 weeks ago at our regular investment meetings, we talked about seasonality. As I mentioned, we looked at August corrections. Typically, what do they look like? What's the norm? What's the median? And about those correction numbers I gave earlier the show. And this week we talked about how none of the other indices, when we were meeting this week at our investment meeting, we talked about none of the other indices were following the Dow. higher. And that was, to me, a bit of a warning. Whenever you see everyone just flocking in those large cap stocks and the cream of the crop, the mega caps in the Dow, and you look at the small cap areas not progressing, well, that made us nervous. And we did take some steps recently in our tactical account. That's our trading account, one that we can be a little bit more aggressive with. We exited our Spain, Italy, and Greece exposure on Wednesday. And we actually did, we decreased our exposure in Japan as well last week by some of the things we were seeing in the yen. And we went double short on Thursday at the open because we saw things were getting a little crazy. If it seems like Jeff, you know, our technicians and us, we were all seeing kind of the same thing, the potential for a dip. You know, we thought it was a good time to make some changes. But like I said, we are not oversold. The only thing I see possibly as a positive reaction that I can't really predict is, you know, what happens between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. If they do come to an agreement, you'll immediately see the market rally. No question with what we've seen and how the market has reacted to news events like this in the past. Uncertainty gets planned out, gets everyone repositioning, maybe building a little bit of cash, buying some treasuries. But when that certainty comes back, we saw it right after the elections, you know, we see the fundamentals carry through. And those fundamentals, like I said, they're really strong right now. But all this aside, it can be scary to think of, you know, this nation possibly, this conflict, talking about nuclear missiles and this nation itself, North Korea, you know, where is its focus? Its focus is on its military growth, not its economy. And what's a nation like that going to do with all that strength, all that effort, all that focus? It can get scary. And, you know, North Korea doesn't know anything different. You know, they don't know semiconductors and production and all that stuff. They know military. And if ever a country needed a paradigm shift, it's definitely North Korea. And hopefully, maybe this is a wake-up call, hopefully for them. And Trump is definitely trying to put it to him.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I don't think this is at the level of the Cuban Missile Crisis, if you follow what I'm saying. That was a lot more white knuckling back in the 1960s with between Khrushchev and Kennedy. And whether or not this is an attempt to negotiate North Korea into whatever concessions they want, I don't know. Because typically, if you go back through it, Ryan, what's happened with North Korea is every time North Korea needs a cash injection, they start making noises and then somebody in the West throws money at them and they go away for a while, you know? And it seems like in this case, President Trump is saying, no, we're not going to do that. So we'll see. You know, if you looked at the cable channels this week, ever since this whole thing broke, there's a huge amount of, chatter about this going on. As a matter of fact, so much so that they really didn't notice too much about what the markets were doing. And, you know, that might even be a bigger story. I'm not sure. But anyway, there it is. We will hope that the escalation doesn't go to some kind of an absurd end, but ultimately can be negotiated out. I think that's where our prayers would go. Ryan Poplava, really good to hear from you. And we'll see you again next week, assuming we're still here.
Hopefully everything's going to be all right. We'll talk to you then.
I'm Jim Poplava. With the stock market at record levels and the Fed raising interest rates, join me and my staff of experts at my upcoming Wealth Preservation Seminar, which will be held in San Diego on October 21st. We're going to cover the economy, the possibility of a recession and bear market, and what signs to look for that this economic market cycle is coming to an end. More importantly, strategies you can use to protect yourself and your family. Make your reservations today, as there will be limited seating for this special event. Call 888-486-3939 to make your reservations today. Once again, that is 888-486-3939. Call now.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
When it comes time for the banks to tighten up credit standards, that in and of itself can cause a lot of problems, you know, and especially during that pre-crisis period, because, you know, debt levels had risen so dramatically and rapidly that there's probably fair to say that there's a lot of businesses that have become dependent on renewing their credit and borrowing even more. And so the moment that the taps get turned off, that can cause a lot of problems. And that's what you find in the stock market as well. So probably probably, you know, there's a few other indicators, but this one is probably one of the key bear market warning indicators that if I was trying to predict a bear market, this would be probably one of the key ones to be looking at.
Well, a little bit of fear creeping into the markets this week, a frenzy over what's going on in North Korea. Are we about to have another Cuban Missile Crisis? Well, investors have been selling off stocks all week. Is this a hiccup, a serious correction, or the beginning of something that you should be worried about? Joining us on the program from StockCharts.com is Art Hill. Art, let's talk with the major averages. 2017 has turned out to be a pretty good year. We've had barely any correction that has mounted to 5% or less. Now we have a bit of a correction. We have some sell-off of technology stocks. Starting from the big indexes, looking at the Dow and the S&P, what does it look like to you as you look at the charts?
Okay, well, when I look at the S&P, we're still in, I mean, clearly in an uptrend because we had a 52-week high on Tuesday. Now, if we look at the big move we had yesterday, it's the biggest, how should I say, prior to May 17th, the S&P 500 had not moved up or down more than 1%. So it had been a really tight advance since May 17th. And then yesterday, of course, we got the very sharp decline and broke below the 50-day EMA, exponential moving average. But prior breaks below the 50-day EMA have been more opportunistic than more of a threat. So I still have to err on the side of, you know, the long-term trend is clearly there, and pullbacks are more opportunity than threat as far as the S&P is concerned right now.
Well, you know, as you look at these indexes, are they being supported by the advanced decline line? In other words, is it just a few stocks, or are the troops following the generals up the hill?
Well, I was looking, and as a matter of fact, at the advanced decline volume line, which is advancing volume minus declining volume. It's computed the same way as the advanced decline line. And if you look at the troops in the S&P 500, they're still doing okay. But then you start looking at the S&P mid-cap 400 and the S&P small-cap 600, and you start seeing some deterioration in breadth. And that's kind of been the case for a little while now because, you know, even though the small cap index has been rising since December, it's been underperforming the S&P 500 by a fairly wide margin. So, again, it's really market cap dependent, this market.
So how much of that reflects what's going on with the flow of funds? Because the big thing right now is passive investing and money flowing into index funds. So, you know, if Vanguard takes in $100 million or Fidelity takes in $100 million, they're going to buy the big cap stocks, the Googles, the Netflix, the Microsofts, the Teslas, all these big stocks that make up these indexes, the popular ones. That's where the bulk of that money coming into those index funds is going. So is that why, for example, you take a look at the Dow, which is looking very, very strong, even though despite the sell-off on Thursday?
That's true. A lot of that money that comes is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, Vanguard gets these inflows and it boosts, they take that money, invest in large caps and push the price of large caps higher. And then the Dow makes the news. And so more people put money into Vanguard and Vanguard puts more money in the market and keeps boosting the market. So I don't know how long it can last. I'm a technician, so I think if there are problems that crop up, it'll bear out on the charts. One thing about the Dow is you had a big help from Boeing, which was accounting, it's like 7.5% of the average. So it was the big driver because it's a price-weighted average, and Boeing was the highest-priced stock. And now I think the one to watch is Goldman Sachs because, you know, they're priced around $223, and they're their second highest priced stock in the Dow. And they were trying to turn up here in late July, but have fallen back below the 200-day moving average. So if Goldman weakens, that would weigh on the Dow itself.
Well, you know, it's amazing because just a couple of days ago, we got the VIX down to 9.52. on the day we're speaking today, we had a spike and then a drop down to about 15. But we're cruising along, very low volatility, 9, 10, and then all of a sudden you get a couple events and news. And, you know, how much of this is kind of like the market looking, if the market was looking for a reason to sell off, certainly the way the media covers this, you and I were speaking before we went on the air. I mentioned the comment by Brian Williams on the national news. He has these experts on North Korea, and he starts out his broadcast, which we'll play later on in the show. Our job tonight is to scare the hell out of you. Well, you know, if you're a viewer at home and you hear some anchor tell you to scare the hell out of you, and this is like the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, I'm looking for bomb shelters, Art. You know, so, you know, what do investors do?
Well, I think when you look at these geopolitical events, they do seem big at the time, but they tend to fade. I mean, if you look at Brexit, you know, that was a big event, put some volatility in the market, and then we bottomed right after Brexit and had a big move up. You look at the U.S. election, of course, that's a local event. I guess it has geopolitical implications, but a lot of people were looking for a downturn after the Trump win, and the market totally, you know, put all the experts, turned them on their head and went straight up and had a big advance. So I think you've got to really pay attention to step back and maybe look at a weekly chart and keep that longer-term picture in mind. And as far as the VIX surge, it went from a historic low in July up to around 15 now, but it's still been trending lower over the past 2 years. And usually surges in the VIX signal an extreme amount of fear that's more, again, opportunistic than more than a threat, because a pullback within an uptrend is more of an opportunity than a threat.
You know, it's amazing when you get these kind of news events in the market. The market's cruising along, as you mentioned earlier in the week. We had a new record for the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Then all of a sudden we get a news event, comments made by our president and the president of North Korea. And you get the safety trade. So you've got treasuries down to low levels. You got a spike in the VIX, and then you also have a spike in gold prices. Let's talk about the safety trade, bonds and gold right now.
All right. Well, bonds and gold have a very strong positive correlation. They've been moving higher since December. You know, it's been a kind of a choppy advance over the last few months, but there's a positive correlation working there. And you had money moving into the yen over the past 3 days, which is, of course, one of the safety currencies, and money moving into bonds. And I think bonds and gold are in an uptrend. And as long as they remain in an uptrend, we have to respect that. I'd also point out that stocks and bonds are up over the past year. The S&P 500 is up more than the TLT, the bond ETF, but they can rise together. Stocks and bonds, because they have been rising together over the past year. So, you know, the fact that bonds are going up in and of itself is not so much a negative. I think it becomes a negative if bonds start outperforming stocks and stocks start underperforming bonds. Then you've got this risk on, risk off dynamic really working when stocks start becoming less attractive and underperforming bonds and bonds become even more attractive. So I think that's what we have to watch out for.
How much of this, as it relates to bonds, because we track forecasts made at the beginning of the year from large institutions to economists. And at the beginning of the year, with the Fed raising interest rates in December, it was thought that we would be at 3% when it came to treasuries as we got into the latter part of the year, as we head into this fall. The opposite has happened. Bonds have come down, even though the Fed has raised interest rates twice. Art, how much do you think this is a reflection of rising rates, even though rates have risen recently with comments by the ECB in Europe? There is still a chasm or almost a wide gulf between rates. I mean, you take a look at German bunds and you compare that to treasuries. In effect, treasuries almost look like junk bonds.
with their high yields. Yeah, that's true.
I know, at 2%, yeah. You know that. But when you look at 0.5% on a German bond, I mean, 2.25% compared to, you know, 0.5% looks, that's a big spread.
Yeah, it is an amazing spread out there. Yeah, treasuries are a bit perplexing in that, you know, we had this big surge, you know, like July 2016, around 1.4% on the 10-year, all the way to 2.6% in December or so, and then been pulling back ever since. It's been a fairly orderly pullback, but we're still, you know, it's still a 10-month downtrend in U.S. Treasuries right now, or 9-month downtrend. And I think, you know, until they break, say, above 2.4% on the 10-year yield, I think that trend is down for Treasuries, which means Treasury bonds go up. So look for a breakout at 2.4% to reverse that downtrend. It hadn't happened yet, though.
You know, given the fact that we had a little bit of scare this week and the media, as they all do, and it's not just the networks. You and I were talking about that, you know, you take some of these big search engines, whether you're looking at Google, Yahoo, or some of those, they are also going with the same kind of trend of sensationalism on news events because it draws in viewers with television. You know, you have Brian Williams saying we're going to scare the hell out of you. And, you know, they play on fear. And the markets, as we know, also work on two human emotions, both greed and fear. And right now we have a little bit of fear going, of which is being reinforced either in social media or it's being reinforced in national media.
Yeah, it's a real feedback loop working here. And as we were talking before, I saw a nice, really good interview with Roger McNamee on CNBC, and he was talking about the escalation that was going on with Google and Facebook because they're competing for our attention. And, you know, we have this 24/7 internet access and everybody's glued to their phones and that, but the amount of content that's coming out there is just incredible. And so they're fighting for our attention. And the way that they get our attention is by inducing fear or anger and getting us to click on that story. And so, yeah, this escalation and this feedback loop is really a vicious circle, and I don't know how long it'll run or what the long-term consequences will be. Maybe we'll just all get fed up and ignore the news and look at the charts.
You know, you're probably better off looking at the charts, because one of the things that I have seen, and this feeds right into the investment markets today. You know, you go back to, Art, when you and I were growing up, there were three networks, and pretty much you didn't have the internet, you didn't have your mobile phones or your smartphones like you have today. So when somebody came home from work, you wanted to know what happened in the world. You found out at 5:30 in the evening news. Today, if you have your smartphone, you have the internet, there's not an event that happens anywhere in the world, whether it's financial, political, geopolitical, that isn't known instantaneously. On top of that, you have instant commentary. I mean, as soon as this North Korean thing happened, you turn on the television and they have experts on North Korea on television. So news is instantaneous today. And do you think that gets reflected in, let's say, market reactions?
Well, I think it can affect the short term quite a bit. But when I say quite a bit, you know, we saw, what, a 1.4% decline in the S&P yesterday. Well, you know, if you look at the longer-term trend, that's not that big of a decline. It's still not enough to affect the longer-term trend. And as Charles Dow put it, you know, he looked at three trends, you know, the primary, the secondary, and then what he called the noise. And he said you cannot predict the noise, and it's based on these news-driven events. And so, yeah, now we've got them, you know, hitting the tape on more and more of a regular basis. But I don't think it has changed that much the nature of the markets, because they still react to these short-term events, and that can affect the short-term, but you need something more to affect the long-term. And I don't think we've affected the long-term trends just yet.
Yeah, because, I mean, if I'm looking at charts of the Dow, the S&P, you're looking at the NASDAQ, you're looking at trends in bonds, you're looking at trends in gold. There has been a trend in place since the beginning of the year, and I'd like to get your comments on this. Number one, the first trend, the stock indexes, both here, I don't care if you're looking at the Dow, the S&P, the NASDAQ, they've been in an uptrend. If you're looking at stock trends globally, whether you're looking in Europe, you're looking at Asia, emerging markets, they have been in an uptrend. If you look at bonds, they have been in an uptrend. And as you mentioned earlier, if you look at gold, that has been in an uptrend. So most major asset classes, maybe with the exception of oil, all of them have been correlated and have been in an uptrend since the beginning of the year. What are your thoughts on that when you see something like that happen?
Well, it might have, I don't know if it has something to do with the dollar, because that's the one thing that has been in a downtrend the entire year, been trending lower. And we did see recent upturns over the past month or so in copper. Copper got a big move up over the past month or so. So it has joined the uptrend. But as far as trying to find out what is driving the trends, I really prefer to focus on those actual trends and try and ride them as long as possible. But it's plainly bullish to see the stock markets all moving higher. You know, when you start to see some of the major markets tailing off and not moving higher, that's when the warning signs appear. But as you said, you know, we've got all the global stock markets moving higher, and that's a bullish indication.
Yeah, usually when you see one or two averages, and this gets back to Dow theory, in other words, if the transports are going up, or let's say the industrials are going up, but the transports aren't, you might say that's a divergence. But when you see U.S. stocks going up, you see foreign stocks going up, you see the advanced decline line supporting that. As a technician, aren't these the kind of things you'd like to see if you have a major trend in place? That's telling you that this is a very strong trend.
Yeah, it is a very strong trend. And that's why, you know, one or two days of weakness is not enough to derail that trend, because the S&P 500 AD line is doing fine. New highs have dried up. That is true. But, you know, we're not seeing a big surge in new lows. So, you know, that's probably the only neutral thing, is that new highs have dried up. But the AD line is doing fine. 68% of stocks in the S&P 500 are above their 200-day EMA. So it's come down from the 70-75% area, but still, you know, well more than 50% of stocks in the S&P 500 are above their 200-day EMA. So that is net bullish. It's enough to keep the broader market moving higher.
So when you look at markets like this, and these kind of events are short term, you would advise, I think, Art, that investors still keep focused on the long term trend. And right now, as you look at that, whether you're looking at even the VIX or the advanced decline line, the only trouble that may be a little bit of a divergence is the small caps. There seems to be a little bit of divergence there. But when you look at the major averages, the S&P, the Dow, the NASDAQ, all of these look like they're in fine shape right now, including the international markets.
That is true. The only caveat is, you know, the ripeness for correction. It's been quite a while. It's been, you know, we haven't had a correction since September, October last year, and that was about a 9-week correction that took about 5% off the S&P 500. So it's been a long time since we've had a decent correction. And also, we are moving into the seasonally, or we're in it right now, the seasonally weak period of the year in August and September. So the fact that we've kind of had this shot across the bow, it's not enough to derail the trends, but sometimes it's enough to say, to keep people on the sidelines, and we could be chopping around for a month or two before we get a resumption. And that would be maybe a sideways type of a correction.
You know, Art, as a sailor, I've always been told the Grand Banks are no picnic in the fall, that the weather gets really rough if you're a sailor out on the ocean. What is it about August and September, sometimes October in the market? If we get something like a serious correction, it always occurs during this period of time, seasonality-wise. What is it about that time of the year? It's almost like, you know, you see the change of seasons between fall and winter. You expect to see that every single year. When it comes to the market, we always seem to see that same thing occur in August and September. What is it about those 2 months that when we get a correction, it happens then?
I don't know exactly why, but August, of course, we do get the lighter volume. And when you get the lighter volume in the market, it can be more prone to violent swings because it doesn't take as much money or volume to push it around. All right. But, you know, in September, we're coming back. And, you know, September is the weakest month for the Dow. You know, over the last 20 years, it's only closed up 42% of the time in September. So, you know, yeah, we are in or coming upon the second weakest month for the Dow, which will be September. August is the fourth weakest month. But the thing is, October is when the markets typically bottom. I've seen a lot of bottoms happen in October, and they kind of happen violently. You have something violent happen in September with a decline, maybe another push lower in October, and then a bottom. But, you know, the Dow is closed up 74% of the time in October over the last 20 years. And it's been up on average 2.4% in October. So, you know, maybe now is a time to keep some powder dry as we head in towards that late September, early October period to watch for that potential bottom or into a correction or sideways consolidation.
All right. So given the fact that most of the indexes, just about everywhere you look, whether it's bonds, whether it's stocks, whether it's gold, they're all in strong primary uptrends. But there is a little bit of weakness in the small cap stocks, and we are heading into that period of time where you're more prone to get a correction. So keep a little powder on the sidelines, but stay with the primary trend. Would that be your advice?
Yeah, I don't think it's enough information or enough. There's not any bearishness out there to say short the market or get out. But, you know, if you're looking to get in, maybe it's a good time to just wait a little bit and let this, you know, potential rough patch ride out. And then look into the middle, latter part of September as a potential area. But watch the charts for that signal.
All right. Well, listen, Art, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners about your website, stockcharts.com. It's one of my favorite charting sites. Tell them what they can find there and some of the things and tools they may find helpful.
All right. Thanks. Stockcharts.com. We have a lot of charting features. You can do bar charts, candlestick charts with dozens of indicators. You can customize the colors. We can also do point and figure charts. We have performance charts. I was talking about the Dow and its seasonality. Well, we have a seasonality tool where you can plug in a symbol and you can look for the 20-year seasonal patterns for anything. You can do copper, interest rates, gold, or a particular stock if you want. And we also got a lot of nice commentary, both free and premium commentary. So when you go on to the blogs tab at stockcharts.com, you'll see the white commentary sections are for free commentary, and you can click on those and read any of those. Greg Schnell, my colleague, is writing about gold miners today, the GDX chart. And then we have the premium commentary if you want to see what John Murphy or Martin Pring have to say about the market right now.
Well, my favorite page is called your market summary page. You've got the major market indexes, the spiders, the industry leaders, currencies, international ETFs, bonds, commodities. You know, it's in one page, you've got just about everything you need to know about the markets. Great stuff. Well, listen, Art, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. The name of the software program is called StockCharts.com. All one word, StockCharts.com. We've been speaking with Art Hill. Art, thanks for joining us on the program, and have yourself a great weekend.
Jim, thanks very much for having me, and a good weekend to you.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program from the American College is Dr. Wade Pfau. And Wade, let's talk about life expectancies because they've changed dramatically. You recently wrote an article, for example, in 1950, the average male had a lifespan at age 65 of maybe 12.8 years. As of the year 2010, it's almost 18 years. And for a woman, it's 20. And I would suspect that that number may even get bigger as we go forward. Let's talk about the implications of that, because most people don't realize they could spend a good third of their lifetime in retirement.
Yeah, Jim, that's right. So in terms of the average American, the life expectancy from age 65 has been increasing by about 1 year per decade, at least since the 1950s. And that has important implications because often people think about, well, my parents lived to such and such an age, that's probably when I'll go too. But even on average, if your parents were about 30 years old when you were born, that's just indicating that you would live about 3 years longer than your parents, just due to this general trend.
Well, the markets are pulling back this week. Fears over a conflict with North Korea. How real is it? Should we be at risk and should we be worried? Joining us on the program is Todd Mariano from Renaissance Macro. Todd, let's start with North Korea. The markets are shaking a little bit, either comments coming from the president of North Korea and then also our own president back and forth, basically saying they would be met with fire and fury. And the markets didn't like the sound of that. In fact, you had one TV anchor, Brian Williams, the other night with experts saying, our job tonight is to scare the hell out of you. So, you know, it almost sounds ominous, like nuclear war is imminent. I just don't buy it, but I'd like to get your thoughts on it.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me back on the program. It's good to be with you and your listeners. You know, I largely share your view that nuclear war is certainly, I would never use the word imminent to describe that situation with North Korea right now. In my view, you know, what markets are really reacting to here is uncertainty. And the uncertainty of a different way, let's say, of engaging the North Korea issue coming out of Washington. And by that, I also mean the flip side, that I don't really view the issue as having changed all that much in its basic contours, even under this new administration. There are certainly strategic realities to their nuclear program and their ballistic missile program that have to be reacted to, that U.S. and regional defense planners have to, you know, recalibrate their own systems and assets to respond to. But by and large, I think the nuclear issue and the missile issue with North Korea, the essential playbook has not changed much. So I think what markets are really reacting to amounts to headline risk because of the comments that the president made. The way I think this goes is certainly not a preemptive strike by North Korea. No one understands better than the North Korean military and now Kim Jong-un that a preemptive strike coming from them would spell the end of the regime. And I think it's important for investors and citizens to remember that what Kim Jong-un wants most of all is the survivability of the regime. That's why he's pursued a nuclear program more doggedly, more aggressively, and more successfully than either his father or his grandfather, and the same with the intercontinental ballistic missiles. So that's the first thing to keep in mind, is that the survivability of the regime remains job number one. If that's true, then you have to say that his behavior may seem irrational to us, but in that context of preserving the regime, actually quite rational in terms of having a standoff weapon that would, you know, preclude regime change. And that's aimed in two directions. That is aimed both at the United States and the United States alliance with South Korea and Japan. But it is also aimed at China, because beyond the nuclear program, beyond the missile program, Kim Jong-un has also made great strides in eliminating domestic threats to his rule. And some of those domestic threats to his rule, investors will remember the assassination in the Malaysian airport, are in fact backed by China. You know, so the standoff is not only aimed at Washington, it's also aimed at Beijing. If war is unlikely, and I also think that a preemptive strike by the United States, the probability of that remains low in my estimation. If that's true, then we're left with looking at a diplomatic outcome. And there the question, I think, has to be, what kind of diplomatic outcome is acceptable at this point? I don't think that the kinds of outcomes we've seen before, you know, in other words, we won't take further punitive measures either through sanctions or, you know, perhaps defense exercises, these kinds of things, if North Korea simply stops, this kind of freeze for freeze idea. I do think that because Washington has staked itself out so far in this issue, something more substantial is going to have to be on the table this time. Otherwise, you know, quite simply, the U.S. will not have won this round, let's say. So that's a process that I think could take some time and, you know, possibly a year or more. And right now we are in an escalatory phase of that process. And over that timeline, there could certainly be further bouts of headline risk that jar markets. I'm not going to say that the outcome is a foregone conclusion, but if it does go that way, this ought to settle back into a cycle that investors are more familiar with, which is that at the end of the day, North Korea is dangerous, but it's a danger that can both be deterred by conventional and now increasingly unconventional cyber warfare assets. And, you know, it's one that markets broadly understand. So I think the market reaction we were seeing this week actually has more to do with U.S. foreign policy than the North Korea problem in and of itself.
You know, what we've seen going back to President Bill Clinton, they act up, they threaten as they're doing now, and then what happens is they get financial aid. And we know that the North Korean economy is, you know, they're in poverty, there's starvation in the country. So typically when the dictator of North Korea, whoever that may be, whether it's Kim Jong-un or his father or his grandfather before him, when they act up, the West responds and gives them financial aid. So it seems like that's what he's trying to do. At least in the past, it's always worked. But with this administration, it may not.
It may not, especially that I don't think there's an easy transaction to be had here. I do think in the end, you're going to be looking at a type of transactional outcome, you know, not a fundamental one in terms of, you know, looking at regime change or looking at war on the Korean Peninsula, you know, U.S. troops, China entering, you know, basically a rerun of the Korean War. You know, if it's a transactional outcome, I just think there has to be a little bit more skin in the game this time. These types of, you know, you freeze your nuclear program where it is now, and we will open up this financial channel, or, you know, we'll allow China to do this. I think there has to be something a little bit more substantial, but I think that what he has done in terms of certainly furthering the nuclear program and taking the missile program to new heights, pun only somewhat intended, you know, those are probably irreversible. What they could do is more, you know, have some kind of international either inspection regime or some sort of oversight, something that they give up without giving up either of those programs, which I don't think would be on the table for them, in order to get to an outcome here that's a little bit more substantive. But, you know, in the end, yes, we are essentially looking to induce the North Koreans to certainly, first of all, dial back the intensity of the test and things like that, or having an unacceptable cost to getting them to get rid of the nuclear and missile programs. Essentially, you're looking at using military and diplomatic leverage to reach an outcome that is far short of what might be ideal. And again, as you were saying, this goes back at least to the Clinton administration, and it's something that markets, I think, are broadly familiar with.
Could you see, though, Todd, like the U.S. putting in, as we are doing now, a missile defense system in South Korea and also maybe one in Japan? Because one comment that really caught me when Rex Tillerson was over in visiting Japan, that if things don't straighten out here and the threats increase, he mentioned or just dropped subtly, maybe we nuclear rearm Japan. I mean, that would scare the heck out of China.
It absolutely would, and I think you're right in pinpointing where those kinds of comments are aimed. They are more aimed at Beijing than they are at Pyongyang, and I think that is absolutely the playbook for the United States here. In my conversations with clients, I've cited a column by Gerald Seib in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago in which he recounted a plan that was laid out by former Defense Secretary Robert Gates. And whenever Gates weighs in on matters like these, I think it's a rare, clear, and possibly unrivaled experience behind that view. And what Gates was essentially saying was that widening the lens to, say, missile defense in South Korea, Japan, you know, possibly also looking at our alliances in Southeast Asia, which impinge on China's regional objectives and ability to project power, widening that lens is the way to exert greater pressure on Beijing. In other words, take the focus off solely the North Korean program and the threat of a military strike on the Korean Peninsula, and start looking at these other things in the region that China and its military planners absolutely abhor. Now, you know, a nuclear-armed Japan, you know, people will remember that the president also brought this up during the campaign, caused a good bit of consternation here in Washington and elsewhere. again, that's actually a fairly controversial issue inside Japan itself. That's not a switch that you just necessarily flick on. So I think, again, the point being, we're trying to exert greater force on Beijing to help us to really take the lead in solving the North Korea problem. Again, in my view, that's something that's going to take time to bear fruit. This is not just something that you spend a couple months of political capital on, you know, and have a new status quo type of solution. A nuclear Japan, nuclear South Korea, you know, I do think those are fairly dangerous outcomes, and that's why they work as effective threats here.
Let's move on to another trouble spot, and that's what's going on with Venezuela. And you have what appears to be a growing dictatorship in terms of the way the president's reacting, the laws that are being passed, and the amount of deaths. It's almost like a civil war is going on there right now. I want to talk about the implications of what this might mean for the global oil markets, because Venezuela is a major oil exporter.
Yes, and that's of particular interest to the United States, given that we are the top buyer of Venezuelan crude oil, because many of our refiners on the Gulf Coast are specially set up to process that kind of heavy or medium grade sour crude oil from Venezuela and from other places. Sort of an unfortunate missing out, unfortunately, a little bit on the shale revolution here at home, because those refiners can't always process the kind of light sweet crude that we overwhelmingly produce here. You know, the administration, in relation to this vote that was held recently in Venezuela to set up a constituent assembly, again, as you were saying, a subversion of democracy in Venezuela, which obviously has been under constant attack and has been in retreat for most of Maduro's term, and certainly for the 14 years of Chavez before that. In my view, the constituent assembly is certainly a new low for Venezuela. And I agree with you that what you've seen there is sort of a slow motion formation of a civil war. I wouldn't yet call it a civil war, mainly because it's more political opposition at this point, you know, despite the very tragic deaths and the expansion of a, if we're going to call it a dictatorship, which I agree with, you know, the expansion of a police state to perpetuate that dictatorship. It's not yet a civil war in the sense of there is an armed opposition that is contesting territory. The government retains a monopoly on the means of violence now, which in political science, you know, is generally the hallmark of a state. And the opposition is mainly a popular uprising, I would say. The administration recently toyed with the idea publicly, which was, you know, intended as a threat to Venezuela, of enacting an oil embargo that would essentially cut off a huge flow of desperately needed dollars for the Maduro regime. The problem with that is that it's not a cost-free exercise for the United States, again, given that reliance of Gulf refiners. And so that's an option that, if exercised, I think would come down the road. And I think likely has to be precipitated by a severe degradation of, you know, the humanitarian situation, you know, the arising of a real civil war, kind of domestic conflict in Venezuela that we don't see yet. Again, it could be simply information and, you know, we're waiting for it to be categorized as a hurricane as you watch the tropical storm forming. But I don't think that we're there yet. So what I think we're likely to see over, you know, the next couple of quarters is an attempt to steadily ratchet sanctions. We've seen this since the Constituent Assembly, an attempt to marshal international opposition to the Maduro regime, certainly to this undemocratic, illegitimate constituent assembly that Maduro has set up. And again, Maduro is really doubling down on Chavez's policies. Chavez also did a constituent assembly in 1999. I think what's the real X factor here, the swing vote in Venezuela remains the military. And right now, they are loyal to the regime, especially at the top levels. But we've already seen, you know, for a long time, and certainly over the weekend, there are definitely pockets, especially among lower or middle officers, that have an interest in preserving democracy in Venezuela and, you know, getting rid of the government. Unfortunately, right now, it looks a little bit more like Turkey, where they're, you know, the buy-in within the military is not significant enough, either at the top levels or just widespread enough for them to actually have the military assets to actually change the facts on the ground there. So, unfortunately, what I think all that adds up to is a steady grind of the current conditions. You know, a lot of people here in Washington and others of us in the analyst community, we've been, you know, Venezuela has looked like an inevitable crash of the government for a long time. But I'm mindful that in the analytical trade, what looks inevitable often turns out not to be. I mean, a lot of people thought that about Cuba in various decades, and that regime has survived. The last point I'll make about Venezuela is that there are certainly not only significance for the oil market there, but also geopolitical significance, because first and foremost, the Cubans, but also Russia and China have a vested interest in the perpetuation of the Maduro regime, of a government friendly to their interests. That's financial, for sure, but it's also ideological. It's also helpful in terms of power projection for all three of those countries. So the United States has a fine line to tread here, and I think the administration has done well so far to ratchet tensions without seeking to necessarily pull the rug out from under the government in the form of an oil embargo, which would raise major question marks for the aftermath, certainly for the oil market.
Let's move to another trouble spot in the world that is changing, and that is Turkey. It looks like moving more towards a theocracy. And then another issue, if ISIS is expelled from its hold on all its territories in the Middle East, do we experience, Todd, a diaspora where basically they don't control any territory, but they're spread out all over, whether in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere, and actually wreak more havoc?
I think that Turkey is certainly one of the greatest concerns geopolitically right now. And, you know, that has not necessarily been mirrored in the market. Turkish equities have done fairly well this year, even after this referendum that essentially transformed the Turkish political system and, as you say, moved it more towards a theocracy, but even more worryingly, moved it towards an authoritarian system. A one-man, one-party rule, Islamist, yes, but also, you know, something that looks much more like Russia, in some ways looks much more like Venezuela than it does like Europe. When I first started, you know, coming up in this business, Turkey was certainly a model of emerging markets reform, a way that orthodox reform could be translated to a very particular cultural, geostrategic location. And there was due concern about Erdogan for a long time in Washington, but the answer was always that he had figured out how to walk that tightrope between Islamism and economic reform. And unfortunately, that has reversed, and reversed hard. And, you know, the implications certainly for the NATO alliance are of great concern because of Erdogan's affinity for and links with Russia, with Putin in particular. And, you know, the fact that in the Middle East, Turkey will always have a prominent and weighty role to play. And like you're saying, with Syria, Syria is a very multifaceted conflict, but in a few of those facets, Turkey is an important player at the table, and that won't change in the near future. So, you know, for the West to be at loggerheads with Erdogan, both, you know, within NATO and outside of NATO, you know, in a strategic nexus like the Middle East, is a distressing geopolitical signal. You know, how that exactly translates into financial markets is unclear, you know, just in terms of, you know, what that would mean for specific asset prices. But I would say I think it's a sort of Damocles that hangs over us as we start to look at what the future of the Middle East might look like. To your second question, I think what ISIS has always represented has been less about, you know, the so-called caliphate that they set up in the Middle East, and more about its ability to win hearts and minds. You know, previously, Al-Qaeda really held that banner, and with their defeat over several years, you know, they became much less prominent. And actually, as it turns out now, Al-Qaeda is alive and well and thriving, but, you know, they have moved to be a more behind-the-scenes player. You know, the sort of front-and-center media-savvy ability of ISIS to establish itself so quickly on the scene was always more worrying to me than the fact that they actually held territory. So I agree with your point that simply a lack of territory won't really defeat ISIS. Obviously, it makes things much more difficult for them. But I would question, one, whether they will, in fact, lose all their territory. You know, the forces on the ground have done an admirable job, you know, backed by the U.S. and Western allies have done an admirable job of defeating them and rousting them from several of their strongholds. But in a place like Syria, much more than Iraq, in a place like Syria, I think it's going to be difficult to, you know, eradicate them entirely from the face of the earth. Therefore, not only will they have always some kind of base of operations in a country like Syria or in a country like Afghanistan, which we can't forget, the proliferation and improvement of technology does have its dark downsides, one of which is the ability of ideologies and organizations like ISIS to reach an audience that would otherwise, in decades gone by, have been much more difficult to communicate with. You know, the fact that we've seen ordinary citizens in Europe and the United States radicalized from afar does not represent a strategic threat to the United States, but it's certainly a worrying signal, one that's far harder to combat than the folks on the ground in the Middle East.
You know, something that strikes me, Todd, and I've been observing this throughout most of my career, when you always looked at terrorism, whether it was in the 70s or 80s or even in the 90s, it was events that took place overseas, mainly in the Middle East. And what we've seen with the events of 9/11, terrorism has moved out of the Middle East and it's moved into Western countries. So we saw the events of 9/11 here on the U.S., first time we were attacked on our own soil since Pearl Harbor. And now you see it throughout much of Europe and even parts of Asia. So it has spread to a degree that we haven't seen before, unlike, let's say, the three or four decades that preceded the 21st century.
Yes, and it's been a process, I think, for those of us in the financial markets, you know, in its most acute phase after 9/11 of folks trying to get up to speed on, you know, who are we attacked by and why? What does this mean for markets? What does this mean for the country? You know, pivoting to terrorism has become a facet of, you know, almost our daily lives in the sense of either, you know, some sort of news. Certainly for the various agencies involved in the national security of the United States, this is a daily struggle. You know, we have some very smart and very brave men and women defending the homeland here. And, you know, most of their successes we never hear about. So the threat is actually, you know, probably more pervasive than most of us even know. It has been much more tangible in Europe, certainly since the rise of ISIS and since the refugee crisis. You know, to the extent that it marshals resources on the part of the West to not only strengthen homeland defenses, but also to attack the threat at its source, I would count that as a victory. Unfortunately, a lot of blood and treasure has already been spent attacking the threat at its source. And the results are good in the sense that we've had a lot of victories against ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups, but not complete in the sense of eradication. And I think that puts greater onus on countries in Europe and the United States to make sure that their homeland defenses are always one step ahead of the threats. And, you know, there are some worrying trends in that direction. Obviously, the EU has suffered for a long time without really having common foreign and defense policy, not spending enough on defense or security. In the United States, we have more bureaucratic issues in the sense of, you know, getting all of our agencies on the same page, not only for conventional threats like suicide bombers, but also for the next evolution of asymmetric threats, which is cyber warfare. And, you know, compared to some other countries, the government side of cyber defense in the United States is sorely lacking. And so while Washington dithers over healthcare and various things like that, there are steps that we could be taking to insulate ourselves against the thing that no one's thinking about, which, you know, before 9/11, that was Al-Qaeda. And that, I think, is our challenge now.
So as we conclude, Todd, the news media is going haywire over North Korea, portraying it as nuclear war is imminent. As I mentioned, Brian Williams said, our job tonight is to scare the hell out of you. I just don't see it. And this is more maybe regime posturing, hoping to settle and negotiate something at the table and walk away with something.
I would agree with you. And I think it's important for investors and just for citizens as well to look beyond the headlines, to look beyond some of the jawing back and forth and look at what is already a very well-established pattern for this conflict with North Korea. If my analysis is correct, I think that in time we will see a diplomatic solution to this. I don't yet judge that there is no more room for diplomacy and that war is imminent. I think we are very, very far from that outcome.
Well, listen, Todd, as we close, if our listeners like to follow the work that you guys do at Renaissance Macro, everything from geopolitical politics to taking a look at the economy and the investment markets, how could they do so?
Best way is to get in touch with us at sales@renmac.com. We're always happy to open a conversation.
So now here comes an important question. When the music stops, who is going to have a chair? Remember the old game, musical chairs? Well, the same thing happens with stocks. You know, if you've been a listener to the show, you know we cover several topics. We talk about the LEIs, the Federal Reserve. And today we're going to discuss risk management, because while the market is still puttering along, there is going to come an end to what would seem to be a Goldilocks scenario. And you need to know how to master the risks. Among them, your own emotions, either fear or greed. And speaking of which, a lot of what drives people nowadays has been the change in the mass media. There are dangers in listening to all of the data points coming out of the media rather than understanding the trends. As a matter of fact, the media tend to be on the path to being more and more sensational in the quest for ratings or in preserving particular narratives which they think deserve promoting. So we'll talk about the art of contrary thinking. That's part of risk management. So we'll have a discussion on the art of contrary to thinking. When the herd's going one way, which way do you go? And the herd are being led by the mass media. All of that coming up today on The Big Picture next as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.